What I'm going to do basically is to state to make a statement of the duality and then to do some calculation that shows the CFT flavor of this boundary field. So well, I'm going to be discussing, as Alex did, the model of eternal inflation, where bubbles nucleate within each other. So it's the model of nested bubbles. maybe just to be more explicit, I mean, we will be dealing with this fractal set at the future boundary. So I mean, eternal inflation is this this fractal which mathematicians know as Sierpinski carpet approximately. So so we have some region in white which is inflating, and then after Hubble volume some regions have fallen into another vacuum, maybe to a terminal vacuum, and then they drop out of eternal inflation. And as time proceeds, the white keeps disappearing, and we are left with a set of measure zero, which is the eternal set. Okay. And yeah, so this is characterized by some branching factor, the number of daughters, and some survival probability. Okay. And in the case of eternal inflation, the survival probability is related to the transition rate. This lambda is the transition rate. Okay. And the fractal dimension of the eternal set would be 3 minus the dimensionless transition rate. Okay, we have a landscape of vacuum, then we have this picture which Alex, which Alex showed, where, yeah, as I said, we have nested bubbles, vacuum within vacuum. And this is the space-time picture, the semi-classical space-time picture, the bulk picture. And what we now want to say is that this can be alternatively described on this fractal set at the boundary. Yeah, as Alex mentioned, we have three types of bubbles. The ones with positive cosmological constant, which we call DS vacua. And then the terminal bubbles, which can be ADS or Minkowski. We're not going to say much new about these two types of bubbles, except we're going to rely on Ben to say that maybe the Minkowski terminal bubbles can be described in terms of their two-dimensional boundary, and perhaps the ADS will also be describable by this Coleman-DeLuccia CFT correspondence. But if this weren't the case, then this picture wouldn't come to full fruition as a conformal theory. Okay. But it might be piped some other way. Yeah, so Alex also mentioned the rate equation. Here it is again. Now I'm writing the rate equation for the volume distribution, for the inflating volume distribution. It is I refers to some inflating vacuum of type I. So the way the volume of vacuum I changes in time is here time is the scale factor time. Okay. The way the volume changes in time is first because it it expands, okay, by the Hubble expansion, and that is 3h. But here we are working in scale factor time, so h is 1. Okay. And then we have the transition matrix. Okay. Which has a term which accounts for the volume gain from other vacua and for volume lost to other vacua. And those lambdas are the transition rates within vacua. And in Alex's discussion, there was only this matrix because he was referring to the fraction of commoving volume. And here we're referring to physical volume, so we have this additional term. But the point is that this rate equation has a solution which is an attractor. And no matter how we start, the long-term volume distribution reaches always some specific form, which was the point of, yeah. It is characterized by an eigenvalue, so this is a number that depends on constants of nature, depends on those rates, that those are constants of nature. And so the, yeah, this distribution, this volume distribution of vacuum is independent of the initial state. So given some theory that supports eternal inflation, this will give rise to this subsimilar fractal. It is independent of the initial condition. And so in this sense, we can say that the theory and the multiverse solution are in one-to-one correspondence. Okay? So in some sense, everything that can happen in this theory is realized in this single one solution. And further, now we want to say that this solution can also be described in terms of a boundary theory. So in some sense, this boundary theory will contain the same information as the original landscape that we started with. Okay, so the proposal is that the dynamics of this multiverse admit a holographic description in terms of a CFT at the boundary. And I want to illustrate this in the context of this simple model, which Alex already described. Okay. So, so here is some initial inflating vacuum in green, and within that vacuum, a bubble nucleates. Now, this is described by this Coleman-Deluce solution, and this would be the space-time picture of this blue bubble, which would correspond to this region here, because the geometry of the Sitter space, okay, and it is glued to the parent, the Sitter space, which has a lower, a higher curvature, through a domain wall. Okay, so this straight line here is in fact the domain wall that separates blue from green. Okay, and it's a plane-like surface. And these hyperboloids we can foliate by null planes, and this gives rise to the flat chart of the Sitter space. And this is sort of the question that Thomas was asking about how weird would those surfaces look. Well, in this embedding diagram, you can see that that we can foliate by flat surfaces, even across different bubbles, okay? And so I can think of this multiverse, which I have foliated by flat surfaces, okay? And what I'm going to do next is to consider perturbations on that section. Okay. Before I get into perturbations, I should define the game that we are going to play. Okay. So first, we must give a formal definition of the feature boundary. So if we have a classical spacetime, what is a point at the feature boundary? Well, we can define it as the past of an inextendible time-like curve. So in a causal diagram, this point P, we draw as a point, but formally we should think of it as this backward-like cone. Okay? So that's the point. Point is a backward-like cone. Now, these two curves have the same past, and so they define the same point P. Here's another point P prime, okay, which is also at the feature boundary, okay. But we will not be interested in points such as P prime, okay. We will only be interested in the eternal set, and these are the endpoints of time-like curves which always remain in inflating vacuum, okay. So that will be a subset of the feature boundary that we will be interested in.
So P prime is the backward backwards cone of the
accelerated curve. Okay, so you're not going to consider, you're just going to consider GD6? Is that how you rule out P prime, or how do you rule out P prime?
I just agree that out of the future boundary, I will only study, or my base space will be the subset E, this tree. Okay? It is the subset of the terminal points. So in this diagram, I'm only interested in the flat part of this diagram. Okay? So I'm just stating that. Okay?
The flat part. I'm confused with the flat part.
Okay. So the future boundary is the set of all points P and P prime. Okay. But I'm interested in the eternal set. This thing here. Eternal set. This eternal set is defined as the endpoints of the terminal inflating curves. But it's a subset of the future boundary.
Oh, okay, okay. And it doesn't go into this Minkowski region at all.
Yeah.
Do you have in mind a particular realization of this, or do you have in mind summing over all possible realizations?
Yes, this is for a classical space.
Okay, so it's a fixed classical space, but presumably in the end you'd want to sum up some of these things.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just go step by step. So this set is very abstract, okay, so to handle it, we make use of an auxiliary surface, which we call sigma p. Okay? And in that simple model, these are just those foliations by null surfaces that cut across bubbles. Okay? These are the collection of surfaces sigma p. Okay? And each point in the future boundary defines a blob on the surface sigma p. Okay? And that blob has a size which is the size of the horizon, okay? By definition, because the horizon is defined by light points. Okay? So, as I say, each point P of the eternal set is represented on the surface sigma P as a blob, and the blob I call PT, and the physical size of this blob is, as I say, h minus 1, okay? And h will change from place to place, so the physical size of this blob will also change from place to place.
The blob where the past light cone intersects the sigma t, or how?
Exactly. And, but the commoving size has this e to the minus t factor. So the later I put my surface, the smaller will be the commoving size of the blob. Now, this gives a representation of this eternal set with a position-dependent resolution, because H depends on position. And so we can think of this surface sigma T as a fishnet of points P sub T. Okay? So this point is that blob. Okay? And I have a juxtaposition of those blobs. Okay? So so this is a conference on holography. So you know that each one of these blobs, if I ask you how many degrees of freedom does a horizon-sized region contain, you will answer that the number of degrees of freedom is equal to the entropy of that de Sitter space, and it's h minus 2. Okay? So I can think of this surface as the site of the discrete theory where each point in the discrete theory has this number of degrees of freedom. Well, in fact, it's the exponential of this number of states. So number of degrees of freedom is defined as the logarithm of the number of possible states. Okay? And what our picture will be is that on scales much larger than the spacing of the fishnet, there should be a continuum description where the amplitude of the wave function of the universe can be calculated by the use of a CFT. Okay? So I will introduce this Wilsonian cutoff. It should be much larger than the maximum of all these position-dependent resolution scales. Now, for fixed Wilsonian cutoff, I can always go to sufficiently late times that psi will be bigger than the maximum of those moving horizon regions. Okay, so in the calculations that I will do, I will always have to be in this region. Okay. So this will be the representation of the eternal set at some finite resolution psi, and this lies is on the surface t going to infinity. So this subindex t going to infinity, what it means is that t is sufficiently large that the fishnet is much below resolution scale psi. Okay, so we are in the continuum limit. So that's what is meant by this subindex t goes to infinity. Okay. In the end, I also want to make the Wilsonian cutoff to go very small because I'm interested in the ultraviolet limit. Okay, so there are two limits here. T has always always has to go to infinity before psi, and then I can let psi go to infinity too. Now, as Alex was discussing, if Babel becomes a fractal sponge in the limit of zero Wilsonian cutoff, and terminal bubbles correspond to holes on this surface, sigma t. Okay. And as I make the Wilsonian cutoff smaller, I see more of these holes, and that's why this has a fractal dimension. Okay. Aside from the holes, I also have normal bubbles, okay, which separate different de Sitter phases. Okay. And the boundaries between those different de Sitters will be boundary surfaces in the 3D theory that lives on this sort of three-dimensional theory. It's not really three-dimensional because we said it's de facto, right? At any fixed resolution, it is three-dimensional. So here comes the statement of the duality, which many people asked before. Okay, so what we say is that the wave function of the universe, as you know, is a functional of three-dimensional configurations. Okay, so these three-dimensional configurations include the metric, but also some matter fields that we may have. Okay. And what we want to claim is that this, we know that the wave function of the universe is given by some bulk path integral, okay? And what we want to claim is that this path integral takes the form of the exponential of the generating functional of a CFT with those sources, okay? So those sources include the metric, okay, include the holes, and include anything you may want to put on your boundary. Okay. So,
flat three-dimensional space, or flat three minus q-dimensional space, or what?
Not necessarily flat because you can put a metric here, right? So,
but you said these were just sources for ordinary fields in the CFT.
Yeah.
So
the metric of the CFT can be flat or can be non-flat. This is how you calculate the correlator of the stress tensor in usually in ES CFT, right? And you just improvise a metric on the boundary, and you take the derivative corresponding to the metric.
So phi bar includes the distribution of holes and bubbles.
Yeah, yeah. So those are all sources.
So for each component of the wave function corresponds to a CFT on a different.
Exactly.
Yes.
So the CFT.
I think you're mixing two different things together. It's true that in a CFT, you can compute the stress tensor correlator by varying with respect to the metric, but you don't have to do that. You can compute it by some other technique.
It's fine.
And it's just a field.
Sure, but this is what I'm
rotating. In a non-fluctuating space.
This is what I'm rotating to. Okay?
But if you do that, but here phi bar is not fluctuating. It's some fixed. It's some fixed.
That's the component. Each one is
right. The non-trivial thing is to claim that this path integral is the wave function of the universe, like Hartmann-Hawking.
This path integral has always been the wave function.
Like Hartle Hawking or something like that.
Yeah, so it's just the propagation.
Yeah. But the rest of it is usually CFT to be a good.
Yeah, so the new part, or maybe not so new, because this is analogous to some other proposals that people have played with. But I mean, the part we check is whether this wave functional has anything to do with the exponential or the generating functional of the CFT, right?
But so does the CFT live on a fixed geometry?
Yeah, so this is the tree geometry, and this tree geometry is here too. Okay?
That's not what you would normally compute. That's not what WCFT would normally be a function of.
Okay, wait and see.
Okay.
I assume that the spatial metric is an argument of the wave function, right?
The spatial metric is an argument of the function, but it's also an argument of the generating functional. It always has been.
So then the answer to the question.
And it always will be. If you put your CFT on a curved space, it will have a different value.
So, but the topology is fixed.
The topology doesn't even need to be fixed. Why should it be fixed?
Okay, so.
Yeah. So you can have a number of holes, which I specify here. Yeah.
So how does this, I mean, Alex was saying he wants some result to stay independent, and whereas you're proposing a very specific state, presumably.
Okay, so, what you're saying is that this has some dependence here on the initial state. Okay, so it does.
Or even that, I mean, what, you have in mind that there's some rule for getting what this W is, isn't it? So that rule gives you a theory, it gives you a quantum state of the universe. So I don't see what's so wrong with Alex seem to be complaining about things being dependent on the quantum state, but don't we want what the quantum state is? I mean, you've made previous proposals, this is a proposal.
I was complaining about the dependence on initial state.
Yeah, so what I'm going to claim is that this does not depend on initial state, because this surface is very far away in the future. The infrared behavior of this amplitude will depend on the initial state, but they will provide a behavior of the amplitude will not.
Okay, so this is a class of theories characterized by sigma dot, but you're saying the dependence on sigma dot becomes
both away in the limit.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so let's skip that. So let's jump to these checks, right? So I have to check that the wave function is indeed takes this form of the exponential of a CFT, right? And so I will do that for linearized tensor modes in the sitter, and this calculation is completely analogous to one that Maldacena did in 2002. With some formal differences, but minor. And then I'm gonna go into these bubbles, okay, and the boundaries between them, okay? And, I'm going to calculate the wave function for linearized perturbations of these boundaries. Okay. So let's first consider linearized tensor modes in the sitter. Okay, so we can adopt this conformal coordinate. And look at the wave function for transverse traceless modes. These behave like a massless scalar. Okay. So we can do a Gaussian ansatz for the wave function at linearized order. And we discover that that the phase of this wave function is given by an expression such as this. I mean, this will satisfy the Schrödinger equation, okay, if this function vk of eta is a solution of the wave equation in the sitter space with wave number k, okay? So here I'm just expanding the field perturbation in wavelengths, okay? And in the end we have to concentrate on wavelengths that are much bigger than the horizon, okay? Because that's where the continuum description applies. Now, this V can be any solution of the wave equation, but it's better to choose it to be a positive frequency mode because otherwise the wave function is not normalizable. And within all possible choices of the positive frequency mode, here we're going to choose the Banks-Davis vacuum, which seems to be the physical one, okay? Of course, there could be departures from Banks-Davis, such as a certain number of particles, but this dilutes, okay? And in the UV, we expect that this will be the right mode, okay? Now we just plug this wave function into this W, and go to the limit when k times eta goes to zero, okay? Eta, by the way, is the inverse of the scale factor, so eta going to zero is scale factor growing, okay? And this takes this form, okay? So it's the functional of the metric fluctuation, okay? It is quadratic because we have only included the action to quadratic order. And this has several pieces. It has this first piece looks like a kinetic term for the graviton, and the coefficient goes to infinity as time progresses. Okay, so what this suggests is that this graviton is not dynamical. So if we interpret this as the action, as the effective action for this graviton, okay. Kinetic term goes to infinity, this suggests that this is non-dynamical. So in the language of the CFT, this graviton indeed seems to be non-dynamic. Okay. Now, the coefficient of this kinetic term can be changed or even put to zero by adding a suitable counter term to this effective action. If you think of this as an effective action for a CFT, okay. But I'm not going to do that. I mean, there's no real use for it, but what I want to discuss, yeah.
This is in the Euclidean, right? So
yeah, but even in the Euclidean.
So I don't know what you mean by that.
What do you mean by that?
Just a gradient.
So that in a path integral, it wouldn't want to fluctuate too much, right?
I mean, the correlation function will go to zero as you take the UV cutoff away, just as you put
a few. Well, if it's a line sample integral or a given integral, this would be a divergent contribution.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you could just canonically normalize H, right? It's not necessarily the right statement.
You could canonically normalize H in a cutoff dependent way. So,
I mean, the only thing I would worry is like when you look at the HQ terms, having when you canonically normalize, basically. Well, I'm not even sure I'm worried about that.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like a problem.
They would be coming, you can, of course, change the normalization, but then when you go investigate how the metric fluctuates, you discover that the fluctuation of the physical metric is zero. But anyway, I'm not sure this is a very important point. So what I would like to discuss is why this form is suggestive of a CFT. Okay. So here, this was just the exponent of the wave function. So now, why is this suggestive of the CFT? Well, first, let me comment on the fact that this has an imaginary part, okay, and from the bulk point of view, this should be there for sure, because the mod square of this gives amplitudes, and so this exponent must have an imaginary part so that this is normalizable, this amplitude, that is probability. Yeah. Sorry? Sorry, I didn't comment that. I'm doing, just for this example, 5D the sitter because it's more interesting. And it has a formal resemblance to the calculation I'm going to do next. Okay, so. But let me comment on this imaginary part. So the real part of the exponent is what makes the mod square decay. With amplitude, so this imaginary part should be there in physical grounds. And the correlator of H calculated from this wave function is just the inverse of this coefficient. Okay. And so that's what I'm saying here. But there is also the non-local part of that exponent, And this takes the form of integral before k to the fourth, log k squared over mu squared, plus analytic pieces, those divergent analytic pieces that we just commented on, which are like a kinetic term. Okay. Now this is indeed the form that one expects in a CFT, and this has been known for a long time. And the first one to compute it was Tombolis for weakly coupled field theories, and it's also calculated through ADS CFT in the context of Lorentzian theories, okay, by these people, and it's by now a classical result. And yeah, if I take two derivatives of that with respect to the metric, this gives me the correlator of a stress tensor, and the coefficient of it is the inverse of the coefficient of the correlator of H, okay, and it's given by this quantity. So this we will call central charge. Okay. Now, yeah, as I said, for a weakly coupled theory has been calculated by many people a long time ago, and the structure of this conformal field theory generating function is something like that. Okay? This is written in covariant form, okay? And so it has the Riemann curvature square and logs of k square over mu square. Okay? So two powers of Riemann give the k to the fourth, okay? It is here, and in this log box is this k square. But in fact, this is far more general, because this structure is determined entirely by the form of the logarithmically divergent term in the effective action. And the coefficient of that is the trace anomaly. Okay, so the coefficient of log mu square, and here the mu is nothing but the inverse of the scale factor. Okay, so that's the correspondence. Okay, so the coefficient of the logarithmically divergent term is just a geometrical quantity. Okay, it's just a trace anomaly. So just by knowing what the trace anomaly is in four dimensions, now the boundary is four dimensional, and that's why I chose five dimensions, I can guess that the form of the effective action has to be this, the non-local part of the effective action. Okay? So now here the number of degrees of freedom would be h minus cube. Okay? We could do the same in 4D. Okay? In 4D, the same calculation leads to a non-analytic piece, which in this case is imaginary. Before it was in the real part, now the non-analytic part is the imaginary part which determines the amplitude. So again, these are analytic pieces whose role is not very clear, but they can be changed in the language of CFT. They can be changed by renormalization or adding or subtracting counter terms. And here the central charge or number of fields in the CFT is h minus 2, okay? And this invites some numerology. If you remember that fishnet I spoke about before, okay? So if I take a maximal possible resolution when the Wilsonian cutoff is similar to the fishnet spacing, okay, then there should be as many degrees of freedom per fishnet points as the number of CFT fields in the boundary. Just a fact of field theory, if you wish, that at resolution, at some fixed resolution, the entropy is dominated by the shortest wavelengths, and the number of degrees of freedom scales as the number of fields. Okay, and we just said that this says it's h minus 2, and this is agreement with what we would expect from that bulk picture of the fishnet. It is also h minus 2. Okay?
Did exactly the C being exactly the entropy of the sitter, or was there some numerical coefficient?
That doesn't have to fit exactly, because the number of degrees of freedom and the central charge are not in 1-to-1 correspondence. Okay. So. But they sort of scale, or you expect them to scale. Okay, so So next calculation I'm going to consider is linearized bubble fluctuation. So here I have perfect circles. Of course, the effective action will not depend on the size of a circle. So if I put a circle or a bigger circle, the effective action will not change because of conformal invariance. Okay? But if I deform the size, the shape of this bubble, okay, this bubble is now a source, okay, for CFT degrees of freedom, then the action will have some dependence on that shape.
So, for example, the partitions vacuum for a CFT in a sphere does.
The answer is no, and the reason is that the conformal anomaly itself is conformal invariant.
I mean, it's not. For example, a CFT on a sphere has a partition vacuum which depends on the radius because of the conformal anomaly. So why? I don't understand.
Sorry, what was that again?
If you take a CFT and put it on a sphere in two dimensions, let's say. The partition function is something like the radius of the sphere to the power c over 3. It depends on the central charge because of the conformal anomaly. I mean, that's what the conformal anomally is, right? It tells you that the...
But in the CFT, yeah, so the expectation value of t depends on r. But here we're talking about the integrated phase anomaly. And once you integrate it over the volume space, there is no dependence. The integrated phase anomaly is conformal invariant, is light invariant. So is coefficient A2?
But you're talking about varying the radius of one of these spheres, right?
So but it's the same. So this is a conformal anomaly, right? Mm-hmm. And depending on the effective action is through this coefficient. Okay. So what I'm saying is that this integrated coefficient is itself conformally invariant. Okay, so but in general, I mean, if I perturb non-conformally, the effective action will depend on that. So let's do the calculation. So here, to do this calculation, I stick to the simplest case, where the parameters of the theory are such that self-gravity of the bubble is not so important. Okay? So the conditions are those two. Here, P is the bubble tension. So these bubbles have an intrinsic wall sheet geometry, which is also a De Sitter geometry. Okay? So the wall sheet of a bubble separating two vacua is a De Sitter space of radius R naught given by parameters such as the Hubble rate in the embedding space, the tension of the bubble wall, and the gap in energy density between the two sides of the wall. Okay. So in the situation where self-gravity of the bubble can be ignored, is not important in the dynamics of the bubble, then it is easy to look at the wave function for linearized deformations of this wall sheet. The wall sheet changes position according to the normal by an amplitude phi. So phi will be the normal displacement of the wall sheet. And if you look at the action for this displacement, it's a canonical wall sheet scalar field with a mass which is actually tachyonic. And so what this means is that for wavelengths which are smaller than the intrinsic radius of the Sitter wall sheet, fluctuations oscillate, but once they come out of this intrinsic horizon, they get unstable. But this instability just says that they grow at the same rate as the size of the bubble. Okay? So the size of the bubble grows, the fluctuation also grows at the same pace. So basically what it says is that it's frozen in sort of sense. As before, we do a Gaussian ansatz. Now we have to work in the closed coordinates because this is the closed De Sitter space, and it's important to pick up all the L dependence. Okay, so we just write this Gaussian ansatz, and we pick up a vacuum state, which again is the Banks-Davis vacuum, now in closed coordinates. So we have this Legendre function. And the index of this Legendre function is determined by the mass of the field. In this case, we know the exact mass, this tachyonic mass, which I mentioned. And so it is P plus 2, P is the P ring, okay, so in this case it would be a membrane, okay, a membrane, so it's P equal to 2 plus 2, 4, divided by 2, 2. So the index nu would be 2. Now, this index 2 is the same index that we had in the case of gravitons in the five-dimensional case. So formally this will be very analogous to the gravitons in 5D. Okay? In other words, we will get logarithmic non-analytic pieces. Okay? The W calculated from the bulk calculation takes this form. Now there is no integral, there is a sum, okay? This delta is just the Laplacian on the sphere, on the unperturbed sphere, okay? So at the boundary we have that two sphere, and we're going to look at the wave function for those perturbations, okay? And again, it has some imaginary piece, and this tells us that those will be bounded, and we have some amplitude, okay? And we have some local pieces, okay? So this again is like a kinetic term, okay? This is a constant term, also analytic in momentum, if you wish. And so, yeah, this is shorthand for L times L plus 1, I guess. And L also comes here. So this L and this are sort of the same. I mean, this would be like L squared. L squared times L squared, this is L to the 4th. This is the K to the 4th again, okay? So, So this is in terms of this normal to the world shift, but in fact, we will be interested, I mean, since the radius goes to infinity, we're more interested in the relative perturbation of the radius, okay? And this is given by the normal displacement, which was this, divided by the radius, which is a tilde. A tilde is just the growing radius of the bulb. And moreover, I have to insert the Lorentz contraction factor because these bubbles are moving, okay? They are moving, and so the actual size is decreased by this gamma. Okay, so once I express it in terms of the relative perturbation, I have this form, okay? And here I have only displayed the non-analytic piece. There are some analytic pieces which I use, okay? But now what I know, so this plays the role of renormalization scale, and I know that the coefficient of the logarithmically divergent piece should be equal to the trace anomaly, okay? So now I have a three-dimensional theory, and you will tell me that a three-dimensional theory has no trace anomaly, right? Because it's a dimension. But this is a theory with boundaries, and the boundaries are two-dimensional. So this gives a contribution to the trace anomaly, okay? And it should be equal to that. So, here it is again. So, I'm just saying that for large gel, this takes this form. Okay. So, I have k to the 4th here. Log k squared comes from this the gamma function. And, what I'm saying is, what do we expect in a CFT with boundaries? So, we expect that the logarithmically divergent term is accompanied by the trace anomaly. Okay. So, when we have boundaries, these boundaries are two dimensional. And there is a contribution to trace anomaly, which has this structure. Okay, so this is an object which is conformally invariant. Matt was asking about the conformal invariance of this effective action here. So the trace anomaly coefficient is conformally invariant in the realization. And then
you would say that those do fluctuate in the CFT. Right, you said that the gravitons, the metric does not fluctuate.
Again, this is a source. This is a source.
Right, but it doesn't have the same type of UV behavior as the gravitons that you were discussing earlier.
It doesn't.
Does it? Maybe I'm missing. Well, you're saying because of that log, or it does?
No. Like gravitons in 3D, you mean?
Well, I guess you were talking about gravitons.
Gravitons in 3D don't have logarithmic divergence. Right, because there is no trace anomaly coming from bulk contributions.
Well, earlier you were talking about gravitons in 5D.
Yeah, in 5D, yeah.
Yeah, and those had some kind of type of divergence, which was not a logarithm.
Yeah, it was a logarithm. Oh, well, there were also there were also analytic pieces. Analytic pieces we never care about, okay? From the CFT point of view.
In the A squared curve?
Sorry?
you're saying is
a square basically. Yeah, we also have it here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so here it is. Okay. So when I redefine the variable, okay, I will also get this square, this square.
Oh, okay. So there's exactly the same divergence in the
case. Yeah. Not exactly sure.
You can see it's exactly the same, but I think it's exactly the same situation.
Yeah. So, but these are
bubbles. What I have neglected the gravitational field of the bubbles, so I'm not sure this will apply to say your bubbles, the holes. Okay. So I don't know about that.
Non-dynamical in the
yeah.
In the
for this case, yeah.
Okay. So So as I say, the structure of the trace anomaly is pieces which depend on extrinsic curvature, but which are conformally invariant. And then, say, I can also have the piece which is proportional to intrinsic curvature of this boundary. Okay? But this is a topological invariant and doesn't change under fluctuation. Okay? But this piece does change under fluctuation. And if you linearize this expression, okay, calculated to quadratic order, it does have the same structure as this term. Okay? And so this is indeed proportional to A3 halves, as we expect. And that's about it. So
maybe this can serve as a summary and conclusion.
So the conformal invariance of the boundary field seems to be supported by this, say, modest evidence. Okay? One is just the correlator of TP in bulk parts. It's nothing terribly new. Okay. Also by the distribution of nested bubbles, which Alex discussed, and finally by the correlator of bubble fluctuation. Yeah, that's all. Thank you.
So what are the fluctuating fields supposed to be then in the CFT?
In the CFT?
Yeah.
I think any massless field.
But what are they? So you're saying all the metric fluctuations have what are the fields of the fluctuating CFT? What are the massless fields? You mean any massless fields you had in the bulk?
Any massless fields that you have in the bulk will be arguments of the wave function and hence sources for the CFT.
So what are the things that aren't
sourced?
What's the theory?
That's a very good question, of course. Even you, but the point is followed. So this wave function, we know how to calculate in the bulk, okay? So this will be some big G, exponential of minus the action of GR plus matter, okay? So, we've found this sigma 0 and sigma, okay? This is the bulk calculation, okay? So now we say that this is e to the I W C of T, okay? And we're thinking, maybe, this can also be calculated as some integral for CFT fields of some I, S, CFT in the presence of the source H. So it will be sources for these guys.
But what are the size? That's my last question.
What are the size?
Yeah.
It's the freedom of the boundary theory. nobody knows.
You can make a few general comments, right? That is, it should have a stress energy tensor. It should have, for every gauge field, there should be a corresponding current. They're the usual guesses you can make.
Yeah, but what do you really case? I mean, it seems like
in some sense there's a bulk wave function,
which can be rewrite as a boundary.
Yeah, the question is indeed, which direction does the field?
For instance, the choice of the Bunge-Lewis spectrum seems to be a bulk choice.
Right.
Is related to a bulk property of the bulk wave function.
Yeah, right.
Which you can reinterpret in terms of a CFT wave function, but it seems that you're defining your boundary wave function by a bulk wave function.
Your boundary wave function or your boundary CFT?
I'm not sure of the.
I don't know of any examples where this is not the case.
Exactly. No, I agree.
Because I mean, you can say that it's perfect couple then goes for super young means, but you cannot really calculate in that theory, right? So,
well, I guess that, I mean, if you change the bulk wave function, or couldn't you just be changing the entire, I mean, let's say I look at the wave function over all possible future metrics, so I just pick some metric and I look at the wave function.
You know, the wave function. Right.
Wait. Let me finish. But now you can change the bulk state. Now, I haven't changed the argument phi bar inside phi bar, I've changed the bulk state.
Yeah.
So every time I choose a new bulk state, am I choosing a new conformal field theory?
You're changing the infrared. That might be
good.
Yes.
How?
Well, so the idea is that the latent behavior is an infrared. That's the whole point.
Yeah,
right. So
it changes in infrared.
What are you changing in infrared? The CFT, there's the state, the wave function.
We're changing the infrared of the CFT.
How so?
You're probably making it not
on because the amplitudes on large scales will change.
Okay, so you're saying you're adding some sort of relevant operator to the CFT. Okay.
Well, you say that.
Well, what else do you do to change the operator of the CFT? I have an operator, I change the state. So it's one or the other.
Maybe. You're changing the infrared. I don't know exactly how.
So I'm confused. Are you saying you change the operator or you change the state?
It could be, I don't know. I mean, I claim ignorance on that. I know that the amplitudes will be different in the infrared, okay? So you like to say that because you've always heard that, that's fine with me. Right?
No, I mean, there's only two ways to do it that I know. So
you can change the state without changing the theory. Maybe, I don't know.
You can change one or the other. But...
Yeah, I'm a bit confused.
You can change the boundary condition because if you could think of this as a finite piece of space, you can change the boundary condition.
You paid a lot of attention to the R squared terms, the fourth order derivative terms, but those are UV modifications of your spatial, or the theory on your spatial slides, right? At least they really are short distance.
I don't understand the question.
No, so I guess you talk, so those R squared terms, your effective actions that you were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a piece that's just the Einstein action, etc., right? Mm-hmm. And you said, well, those are analytic and non-universal. But those are the ones that determine the law of scale physics.
Are you saying Einstein action in the boundary or in the bulk?
There is an Einstein action in the boundary also. At least that's it.
That's
right. Yeah, so all the terms that I'm seeing here.
Yes, so this is the Einstein boundary.
Right.
Besides.
So that one determines the low, the small k is dominant for small k.
Mm. Sure. So, but this goes to infinity at the boundary. Okay, so
sorry.
This scales like k. So at the boundary, this piece is divergent. So Planck mass goes to infinity.
Are we really taking that limit?
Yeah.
So we're really at time equals plus infinity.
Yeah, we go to the limit. Go to the limit, but you can even know. This is a quadratic divergence.
Aren't we just saying?
This is a quadratic divergence in a local. Okay? So in the UV, that decouples.
Yeah, but now you're using the CFT language, but the actual, at least if I want to know what the wave function describes, then that term is pretty relevant because it leads to gravity. It's the thing that tells us that things gravitate.
In the 3D?
In the 3D, yes.
What this suggests is that they don't gravitate, right? Because you go to an Planck bounds.
Yeah, that's because you're taking the limit where our universe has expanded, has gone through an infinitely long disintegration expansion.
That's
no longer gravity.
I'm trying to define the theory at the future boundary. Okay? So, that's the
idea. I mean, that term would be there in ADS, right?
Yeah.
It is there in ADS, yeah. But indeed, and from the field theory perspective, you would be not. Normalized.
So I think he's just saying the same thing as reasonable.
Right. So you're talking about this future theory that some kind of local continuum theory defined on the three on the spatial slice without any gravity.
This result suggests that we should take this path.
But we were just saying that such a asymptotically stable the city space doesn't exist. So in principle there should always be some kind of cutoff.
So you specify a configuration, and that's the argument of the wave function. So I don't see where the mystery is.
I'm just not comfortable with it. I understand the philosophy.
It seems to me there's some basic confusion here. I mean, you can always keep saying it's the argument of the wave function, but I mean, a CFT is a machine for computing correlation functions in a fixed background. At least every CFT I know about is a CFT of that sort.
So you fix the background.
So in particular, it wouldn't normally be a machine for computing correlation functions of holes in the space.
So that only can be you identify this with a wave function, and then from that you calculate, say, a probability distribution for H's.
Okay. Do holes in the space in the bulk correspond to holes in the space that the CFT is living on?
Yeah.
Okay, but a CFT is not a machine for computing relative probabilities of having a space with holes in it and having a space without holes.
No. CFT is a machine for calculating that only.
Yeah, in a fixed background.
With fixed
holes.
Yeah, fixed holes.
It's not a machine for comparing different probabilities for different numbers of holes.
No, given CFTs.
That's the
family of CFTs.
That's the statement of the duality.
You will need the range of CFTs.
That's right. Each H and psi of H defines a different CFT.
It's a different CFT. I mean,
that's right. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So you need a whole.
I wouldn't call it a
distributed.
It's on a different background.
It's on a different background.
Same CFT. Well, I don't know.
But on the other hand, there could be external information that still provides a measure on the different topologies. The CFT indeed might not.
I think it's a different CFT.
Okay, so here. That's
the configuration of holes.
Here's the question: is it external information which tells you how to sum over topologies and metrics? Or is that internal to the CFT itself? Do you need to specify something additional?
A simple example is string perturbation theory.
Yeah.
String Wolfschmidt is a CFT.
Okay.
And the CFT does not completely fix the relative weight between different topologies because that's the string coupling constant.
Uh-huh.
So the analog of the string coupling constant, which in this case would be many coupling constants because the topology is more complicated.
Yeah.
Might be external information on top of the CFT.
I think I know what you're referring to. So we have difficulty comparing the relative weight of two.
The relative weight between topologies, which may not be
different topologies. Yeah, because this is actually a diversion thing, and so when you have to compare different topologies, isn't clear how you have to.
Any topological invariant might be an additional term. Of the three geometry might be an additional.
Yeah, correct. This is seen even here because, as I say, this coefficient A2 has topological pieces. So those will change the value of the CFT.
Or does it change the relative weight of the different?
Yeah.
And so, what exactly is the duality that you're proposing? I mean, in ADS-CFT, the duality is that any physical measurement you could perform in ADS, any process that can take place, has a dual in the CFT. And you don't need anything more, you just need that CFT. And that's what
I know that people say that, but I just stick to this equation.
Okay, but so it's a completely different proposal, because here, there are many physical questions you could ask in the bulk, which could only be answered by summing over several CFTs, right?
I will not commit to anything that is beyond that. Okay. So, if there is something beyond that, welcome.
That's the right
question. But I mean, people are talking about holographic superconductivity. I mean, tell me what is the underlying theory.
I mean, you might want to know what's the probability that you're going to fall into a bubble, or that you're going to see one, or something like that. And it doesn't look like you could answer that question in any given copy of this.
There are various models you can draw from that. So I don't know how far this can be carried. But we were talking before in analysis talk about for the measure. Okay, so this suggests this kind of measure based on this boundary theory. But what I have discussed here are properties of the wave function. So this conformal invariance is somehow a property of the wave function, right? So even if there is no boundary theory, it's based on this formal property of the wave function. You could argue that maybe that's a path to singularity. So, I mean, there, I don't know exactly how much further this can be pushed.
Okay, so I think it should be about. Thank you, Jeremy.